It's always a perfect day for books, but I think today is an especially perfect day for the Boston Book. Yeah, it's going in and out. How are you guys? I'm just going to shout until it works out, until we've got it. Okay, of these two absolutely wonderful books, All Joy and No Fun and You Are Not Special. And my name is Carrie Goldberg. I'm mostly a health and science reporter at WBUR, but I've written a few very deeply felt pieces about parenthood because that's kind of where I live in my heart. And I wanted to, as an introduction, to share with you a couple of brief revelations that I've had as a parent that are part of the reason why I love these books so much. The first was when I was a brand new mother and my baby daughter was sick and I was kind of quaking and hovering and worrying, and I suddenly had this epiphany of with blinding force that went in these exact words: oh my God, we made our mothers who they were, these anxious creatures with these tedious lives, and then we blamed them for it. So it was like that sudden realization that my mother was who she was because of me, and yet I was always complaining about it. And then the second great revelation, and this usually happened at the kitchen sink while I'm washing dishes or something, was that parenting is just so hard, and I feel that way even though I have the absolute best case scenario. I have easy kids, we're okay financially, and yet day after day after day, I find it very, very hard. And then the corollary thought of that was, oh my God, I must be so spoiled. I'm so spoiled. Why did I ever think that it would be easier? And these are just some examples of the sort of the fabric of my inner life that has been going on for the last dozen years since I became a mother. And it's what Jen so beautifully calls the ticker tape of concerns that's going always through our minds. And I feel like I continue to wrestle with what it is to be a parent, even though it's the most central thing in my life. And so that's why I'm just so incredibly grateful to both of these authors for their brilliant insights and their reporting from life and from every other, from work, from reporting, from books, on what it is to be a parent and a kid specifically in 2014. I feel like that's one of the great treasures of their work, is that things have changed a lot and we're all groping to try to figure out how to parent in this current environment. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our two authors. Jennifer Senior is, her book has been on the New York Times bestseller list for seven weeks. She spoke at TED, she spoke at the Sydney Opera House. She has been a staffer at New York Magazine for the last 18 years, also 1 year at New York Times Magazine, and she's a regular contributor to the New York Times Book Review. Her son is now seven, and she's also this almost seven, and she's now the stepmom of two older kids as well. And so she'll be speaking first. Then David McCullough, I asked him what to say about him, and he said, well, just say I've been a teacher for a long time and also a father for quite a long time of four wonderful kids. He teaches at Wellesley High School, as far as we know, no pink slip we've seen, and he's married to a very smart woman who constantly feeds him great stuff, apparently, and who was smart enough to tell him before he made his now classic commencement speech at Wellesley High in 2012, which went so viral that it's now been viewed well over 2 million times. It's titled, You Are Not Special, like the book. So his wife was smart enough. He was saying, no one ever really listens to the commencement speeches anyway. And his wife was smart enough to suggest that they perhaps go over it before he delivered it. So he calls himself a Joe Everyman who was struck by lightning because this speech went so viral and has been made into a book. But when you read the book, you can see that he's no Joe Everyman at all. He's a fabulous thinker and wordsmith. So he will go second, and then I'll ask a couple of questions, and then we'll throw it open to the audience. So, Jen.
Thank you. Oh, am I on? I don't think so.
Do you want to stand up here?
I could.
Yeah.
Check that out. Magic. Thank you. Okay.
Do you want to stand up?
Thank you for that. I don't know. Stand, sit? Does anybody, does it look weird, or does anybody care?
Stand's better.
Stand.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hey, I'm going to stand.
Then I'll be double mic'd. Whoa, okay. Yeah. Anyway, thank you for that lovely introduction, Carrie, whose work I've adored for years, by the way. And thank you to the Boston Book Festival for inviting me here. I should just say, I have a 60-minute version of this talk, I have a 40-minute version of this talk, and I have a 20-minute version of this talk. This is the first time I've tried 12. Bear with me. I'm not going to speed through it, but, you know, it might be a little... Okay. So... back in May, I was doing a reading, and during the Q&A part, a woman in the back of the room raised her hand. And she was lovely to look at, early 30s, I'm going to guess, and she was visibly agitated. The distress was legible on her face. And it turned out that during the last few days, she'd been feeling wretched because she had made a promise to her son, and she'd broken it. And now he was crushed, and her conscience was tormenting her. And what she wanted to know from me was, what should she do? Should she buy him a gift? Should she simply apologize? What? Now, I just want to start by telling everybody, I don't usually answer questions like this. My field of expertise is parents. It is not their children. But even I felt comfortable actually weighing in on this question, and I will tell you why. As she was speaking, it came out that her son, who I imagined was fuming in his room or was genuinely reeling from some kind of cosmic miscalculation she had made, it turned out that this kid was 18 months old. That's it. A year and a half. So when I heard that, I was like, no problem. If your kid is 18 months, you can basically tell him that, like, he's going to be throwing out the opening pitch at Fenway Park next week, and he's not going to remember it. Like, he won't. And if he does remember it, he's not going to hold it against you. That is the beautiful thing about 18-month-olds. They do not walk around in this world with giant satchels of resentment on their back. They don't even have the neurocircuitry to form grudges. You're fine. But in retrospect, what I think is so interesting, obviously, is her guilt. She felt terrible, which kind of raises this question, right? How did we get here? How is it that some of us are now laying awake at night trying to plot our way back into the good graces of our toddlers, right? And I know what you're going to say, which is that she's an exaggerated case, and it's true, she is. But I think many of us parents are sort of caught up in this kind of false and very insidious conviction that parenting is a science and not an art, and that there is a right way to do things, or at least a much better way than the one that we are doing right now. So this is the part where I tell you that I don't actually care about child-rearing debates at all. I don't care about that. I am much more interested in how kids affect their parents than how parents affect their children. I'm interested in that mom. I want to know what conspiracy of forces got her to that place that she was so panic-stricken and so anxious and so completely cross-hatched with feelings of guilt and shame. I started thinking about this question years ago when I was doing a story for New York Magazine. It was a social science story. And I learned that one of the most robust findings in social science is that kids do not improve their parents' happiness at all. If anything, they compromise it. This is not a random one-off study. This is robust, stretches back 50 years. The most famous one was done by Daniel Kahneman in 2004. I'm sure most of you, if not all, know who he is. He wrote Thinking Fast and Slow. He won a Nobel Prize. So this became an instant classic. He and his colleagues went to Texas and interviewed 909 women, all working women, and asked them to do two things. One, recreate what they did the day before. Two, say how they felt about what they were doing about each thing. And unbeknownst to them, taking care of their kids clocked in 16 out of 19 in pleasurability. So things that clocked in higher included vacuuming, which is to say that housework clocked in higher. Also, napping, which is to say that losing consciousness entirely was considered preferable to spending time with their children. So when I read this, I thought, okay, I'm doing two things. I am going to do a deep dive into all of the literature that talks about the ways that kids affect their parents. Because it's all there. You just have to go spelunking into different silos of social science. You have to recruit from sociology and anthropology and psychology and economics and history and philosophy. It's all there. You just got to get it all in one shuttle and weave it all through one loom and you're done. It's great. And the other thing I wanted to do was I wanted to bring all of this research alive in case studies, in real families, because I am a sucker for case studies. I love Freud, I love Oliver Sacks, and research alone is dull as nails, and I didn't want it to take place mostly in New York because I love New York parents, but we're crazy. So I went around the country and looked at families, and I looked at how kids affected their parents at every stage of their development, right through adolescence. Okay, so what can I say about these studies, right? This very robust body of literature? I mean, they're an interesting launching off point for a book. Not much else. I spend about 2 pages on them. I think that something is clearly missing from them, right? Something is slipping right through the sieve of social science. If these studies cannot tell you about the transcendent moments of joy that kids give you and that vectored sense of purpose that they give you when you wake up in the morning. However, they are probably showing us something crucial about our moment-to-moment affect as we raise kids, that something about our well-being in a day-to-day way is compromised. And to the extent that that's the case, I want to stipulate something right now. Kids are not the problem. It's something about parenting right now in 2014 in America, as Carrie said, that is the problem. I think parenting has really changed. I'm going to name 3 ways very briefly that I think it's really changed. And then I'm going to hand it over to David. So here's 3 big changes to consider for all of us. The first is choice. Sounds obvious. It's worth fleshing out. In Plymouth Colony, there were 8 kids per family. In 1850, there were 5. And today, there are 2. Just 2. So imagine how much value we assign to each of those 2 kids when we finally have them. This is just the basic principle of economic scarcity speaking, right? I mean, we just assign more value to those things that are rare. We also defer having them. If you are a college-educated woman today, odds are you're going to have your first baby at 30.3 years old. So again, imagine how much significance we assign to this project of child rearing if we are waiting for so long. It's the capstone to a life. It's not something we do along the way. It's this great end goal we are hurtling toward, just the way that marriage was in a Jane Austen novel. Same thing. So that's 1, choice, big deal. 2 big change, our work lives are different, and therefore we parent different. Now, I could spend forever talking about the ways that our work lives are different, and I do in my book, and the consequences that this has for parenting. Here I'm just going to focus on 1 thing. Women do it. Women's workforce participation now is at almost record highs. 4 in 10 mothers are either the sole breadwinners or the primary breadwinners in their homes. And you would think, that under this new kind of arrangement, we would have arranged new contracts with our spouses about how to divide up the chores. We haven't. And this is a huge source of marital tension. Marital satisfaction goes way down after a baby is born. And this is primarily the reason why. It's something banal. It's chores. Now, you could say at first blush that that's weird, because according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, men and women theoretically do the same amount of work each week. Men do more paid work, women do more, you know, unpaid work, and at the end of the week, you add up the ledgers, and they're pretty much even Steven. The problem with this kind of analysis is that we don't experience our time or our work in the same way. So let's just take something basic like childcare, which women do twice as much of. Childcare, if a woman feels that she is getting a raw deal on childcare in her relationship, her marital satisfaction is going to go down by a full standard deviation. That's not going to happen if she feels like she's getting a raw deal on vacuuming or dishwashing or yard work. It's childcare that really upsets her. And you can ask why. I have some theories. I'll give a couple. The kind of childcare that women do is more deadline sensitive. We wake up three times as much in the middle of the night with our children, even in dual earner families. It's worse if it's not dual earner. Also, we do more multitasking in the home. Men multitask more outside the home. So the home for women is not a haven. It's a place of keen discombobulation and time fragmentation. It's the opposite. And I think this explains why, if women can locate a chunk of leisure time somehow miraculously, their cortisol levels do not go down. They do for men, but not for women. I don't know if anyone in here wants to take a guess about what does make their cortisol levels go down. Researchers at UCLA have started looking at this, and the answer is phenomenally funny. Anyone want to guess? I usually hear wine and chocolate, which I'm sure helps, but here's the one thing we know. If they see their husbands doing chores. Totally. All right, so that's number two. The third change, big change. By the way, if I had more time, I would tell you that men aren't slackers either. They do a lot too, but I don't have time. we'll do that in the Q&A. No, they've done a lot. They really have. The forces conspiring against them are terrible. The third thing, I would make this very brief, but it's the most important. The historical role of the child has changed, and we never stop to consider this. But kids used to work. They used to be economic assets. They worked on our farms, they worked on our factories, in mines, in mills, in the street trades. We banned child labor, and thank God we did. But it was only very recently that we did this. And even in 1940, half of American high school boys were still dropping out of school to go work. It was not until the Second World War, or after the Second World War, that the sheltered, education-focused childhood, as we know it, first came into existence. And that changed everything. Let me tell you, I am not pining for the Dickensian days of yore when kids were working, but I am going to point out that this changed things dramatically. The economics of parenting changed completely once kids weren't working. Kids became, in the words of one sociologist who I love, who I really love, she put it this way. She said, kids became economically worthless, but emotionally priceless. Now, this was fine in the 1950s when income inequality was at record lows, but by the 1970s, wages were stagnating. By the 90s, we were globalizing, right? So there came a point where you couldn't just shelter and educate your kid. That wasn't enough. You also had to raise a species of super child just to make sure that your child had a toehold in the shrinking middle class. So today, kids are working again. But their work is very different. Violin lessons are their new work. Soccer practice is their new work. Doing college calculus in 10th grade is their new work. And, you know, that's fine. I'm sure David's got a lot to say about it. I'm not sure that's good for them. And we can say that that work certainly doesn't benefit the family. It doesn't benefit their parents. It actually drains their parents. It drains resources, right? It doesn't add income. It subtracts it. Who's paying for those violin lessons? Who's driving them to soccer practice? Who's checking their homework? We are. So I just want to end by pointing out that as a historical proposition, this is brand new, right? In a very short period, we no longer have a reciprocal relationship with our kids anymore. In a very short period of time, our kids have gone from being our employees to our bosses, effectively. And I'm sure David has plenty to say about that. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm David McCullough Jr., so I'm happy to follow Jennifer Sr. I've long thought I'm weird, and it's nice now and then to hear statistical confirmation of that. The happiest day of my life was the birth of our first child, and every day since then has been a joy. Being a father, being a husband, being a teacher. I love kids. I love everything about them. They're fun to watch. They can drive you crazy, absolutely. When I stood up here, I imagine your first thought was, this guy looks just like Jane Goodall. I can assure you the similarities don't end there. I, too, am interested in a species of primate, and while I can tell you very little about chimpanzees, I can tell you something about teenagers. For nearly 30 years, I've been a high school teacher of English. For 20 years now, I've been a father. Janice, my wife, and I have four children, three of whom were teenagers at the time I gave the fateful speech, one of whom I brought along just so you could see what one looks like. I snared him from the wild this morning, and he said, "Where are we going?" I said, "Oh, I'm going to participate. I'm the lesser half of a little talk in Boston." And he said, "Well, okay, don't mess up." So this is Ethan McCullough. Heath, stand up, pal. That's a teenager. That's what they look like. Ethan is a sophomore at Lincoln Sudbury High School out in Sudbury where we live. 2 years and some months ago, I was asked to give a commencement speech. I don't mean to suggest it was for me no big deal. It was a nice honor to be asked, but I'd given commencement speeches before and promptly forgot that I'd accepted that nice request. And as the date finally loomed, Janice, my wife, came out into the driveway as I was loading daughter into the car so we could drive together down to New Jersey for yet another soccer tournament. And she said, "Aren't you giving the commencement speech next week?" I went, "Yes, I am." And so driving from Sudbury to New Jersey, I mulled while daughter did her homework the whole way and thought about what I might say. And the next morning, I got up quite early and took dictation, really, from memory about what I'd been mulling about, and then closed the laptop and went on, and we had our weekend. And on Wednesday, the speech was supposed to be on a Friday. On Wednesday, Janice came to me and said, "Would you like to read to me your speech?" And I said to her, "What for? Nobody listens to these things anyway." And she said, "No, come on." So we went into the living room, and I read it to her, and she said, "Oh, that's good." And I really had no anticipation of making any impact whatsoever. I stood up at the ceremony on Friday evening. In fact, Ethan was there. And I delivered the speech, and standing there, I thought, isn't it nice they're listening to me? And they seemed to chuckle in the right places, and they were receptive from my point of view to what I was saying. And when the ceremony was done, and I came down the steps from the stage on which I was sitting, I noticed, breaking from the parent section, the parent and family section, a beautifully dressed older woman, a grandmother, I took it. And she was coming at me at a dead run. Now, when you see a 75-year-old person coming at you at full sprint, one stops. So I stopped, and she grabbed me by the arm, and she bathed me in praise like I'd never heard before. It was magical. I loved it. And she asked me, "Now, could I have a copy of your speech?" And so I just handed it to her, not knowing it was an historic artifact. And I said, "Sure, thank you very much." And as she stepped aside, standing behind her was Tommy Zink, who is the head custodian at Wellesley High and a good friend. And he's standing there with his hands on his hips, shaking his head like this, and he said, "That was expletive awesome!" And so I thought, between the two, the spectrum represented by the grandmother and Tommy, that maybe something unusual had happened. Within hours, the email box started, inbox started exploding, the voicemail, it was like nothing I'd ever experienced, certainly not like nothing I'd ever imagined. A mild-mannered, middle-aged, largely vanilla high school teacher is not really the formula for a lot of attention, but suddenly, slam, it came. Limousines appeared in our driveway, TV trucks. Suddenly, I and my speech were international headlines, my favorite of which was the Daily Mail in England, which said, "American teacher goes on bizarre rant." A few days later, I took Ethan and a friend to the Red Sox game, and I was standing in the line at the hot dog stand, and a man was staring at me. And I could ignore it only so long, so I finally turned and sort of looked at him and smiled, and he went, "Hey, speech guy." And so I feared that theretofore I would forever be known as speech guy. And if I ever merited an obituary, which I kind of doubt, I'm sure that the second sentence would be speech guy. Among the 1,000-plus emails I got was the invitation to elaborate on what I'd said in the speech in book form. And Janice and I went down to New York to explore what this might be about, and fairly quickly I took a leave of absence from school and spent a year writing. Unlike Jennifer, whose wonderful book they should be handing out in delivery rooms as parents are exiting, I did no research for mine. I did research, but it was 30 years of research in the classroom. It's research just being a father, being a husband, being an observant member of our community. And I wrote for 9 delighted months. I thought it was great fun and very satisfying to do. And I expressed my concern that our children are under tremendous pressure to become achievement machines with the purpose of impressing the admissions offices at prestigious colleges. This has become their reason to get up in the morning. High school has been redefined as that. At Wellesley High School, it's a three-tiered environment there, the honors courses, the normative level courses, and then the remedial courses. And the mid-level courses are known as advanced college preparation. And I sort of resent that title. I don't think what I'm doing in my classroom is advanced college preparation. What I'm hoping to do in the classroom is ignite excitement about learning. If it prepares them for college, terrific. And if it prepares them to be impressive when they stand before admissions committees, great. But that's not my job, nor should I think it should be parents' jobs. Kids need room to fail. They need room to feel like they can exercise a little self-determination. And if the adults in their lives stake out all the appropriate behavior, the only place left for them to feel a little independent is screwing up. School, though, to me, should be this wonderful laboratory where they're free to experiment safely. They can learn responsibility that way. It's good for a kid if the second baseman forgets to cover first base on a bunt that the coach goes out and yells at him. He's learning a little lesson in responsibility. He's learning a little lesson in teamwork. It's good for a kid if he stays up watching 11 reruns of The Big Bang Theory and then fails the math test the next day. Ethan soared through a math test last year that he did not study for, and I've been mad about that ever since, because the lesson that kid learned is dangerous. Parents are interceding all the time when kids screw up even a little. A B minus is now understood to be a bad grade. A C is a crisis, and the parents intervene. I probably should stop.
I don't know.
Parents are showing up now to conferences to express their dire concerns about their struggling child with, quote, advocates in tow who operate like lawyers. It's like we're negotiating deals rather than discussing the well-being of a child. Kids are being tutored when they're what we define as struggle now is merely not shining grades. And kids are being tutored to the nth degree. They're being coached. They're being enrolled in courses. They're being sent to sort of boutique-y specialty camps in the summer to polish up some skill, all with the, in some cases, distant hope that they will be impressive for a very narrow list of colleges. The baby on board sticker one sees in car, I've always wondered, what would compel somebody to, do you think the guy behind you on Route 2 cares? The baby on board sticker you see in cars then becomes My Child Was Student of the Month at Shady Grove Middle School, which becomes Amherst College. The expression, to me, the expression of vanity that sends tells the kid, look, mom and dad have a lot invested in your success, and we want the world to know it. The car seat, to me, is a lovely metaphor for how children are being raised today, too. In the car seat, the child is protected, he's driven, and he's aimed in one direction. Now, I would never suggest that car seats are a bad idea, but they do have their consequence. And kids get this idea that they are, excuse me, special. And special is a lovely word because it's a safe way to say superior, that I stand out against the competition, when of course it's the statistical inevitability that most of us are average. Kids get the idea then that if I'm average, I'm a failure. But again, it's a statistical inevitability. But then I think, well, statistics are flawed anyway. After all, the average high school student has one breast and one testicle. So, of what value are statistics? I'll stop with that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to make a couple of comments and ask a couple of my own questions, but really what this time is for you to start thinking of your own questions, which is by far the most fun part of this for the authors, I think. So first, I couldn't help, Jen, when you were talking, to be reminded of one of my favorite New Yorker cartoons ever, where there's a woman lying in bed clearly with no clothes on and in the covers, and her husband is standing nearby in an apron, and he says to her, "Do you have any fantasies that don't involve me doing housework?" And David, what I wanted to mention, by the way, was that I don't know if anyone who is a reader of The Globe, but a couple of days ago, he brought the bar for parental gratification to a newly unreachable height. Like, I'm happy if I get a little Mother's Day card. He had a piece in The Globe dedicated to his historian, renowned historian father, that was headlined, "David McCullough, Boston's Gem." So hope your kids can get a story like that in the newspaper for you. And it was beautiful and it brought me to tears. So it's very worth reading if you possibly can. Okay, so I'm going to ask a couple of my own questions. I'm hoping that this will unleash your inner narcissists and allow you to ask questions about your own biggest issues as parents or as observers of parenting. So the first is that, and I, Jen, I embody all of the changes in parenthood for you. I only have two kids. I had them very late. You know, it's all, and I find that for me, by far the biggest challenge of parenthood is fear and anxiety, and mostly about my kids' health, actually. Even though they're healthy kids, but I'm a health reporter, and so I'm always learning about the latest viruses, and I also had a friend who lost a child. I know. And so my question for both of you, if you'd like, is as parents, how to deal with that fear, because it's tremendously unpleasant. It's like I have found myself making little deals saying, like, I'll forego all of the joy of watching my kids grow up if I can just be sure that they can grow up. You know, it's just sort of like, so maybe it's just my pathology, but do you have any words of wisdom?
Now
you are.
Now I am on? Am I on? Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
So yeah, I have a couple of things to say about that. The first is anxiety about your kids' mortality. So the last chapter in my book is about joy. And I use the definition that George Valiant, who is, he's in charge of the grant study that started at Harvard with JFK's class, looking longitudinally at this group of young sophomores and looking at them over the course of their lives and what made them functional and what made them not function. It's a beautiful study, and he's been the custodian of it for years. His definition of joy is just a sense of profound, fathomless, bottomless connection to someone or something. And obviously, one of the main relationships that we have in our life that is joyous is with our children, this profound, bonded sense of connection. But what he noted about joy was that it is in some ways a harder emotion to tolerate than sadness. Because if you are truly, if you're going to open yourself up to joy, then what it means is that you are opening yourself up to the possibility of loss. And that you could lose this thing that you love, or this person, or these people who you love so, so very much and who are irreplaceable to you. And he wrote something that I have never forgotten. It's this beautiful little aphorism. Joy is grief inside out. And I think about this all the time. I think it's also why anytime something like Newtown happens, every parent feels sickened in a way it feels like it happened to them. Yeah. And so what you're describing, I think, is in some ways part of what being a parent is. I don't think it's actually your special neurosis. I think it's what joy is. I think it's the other face of it, and it's something that we all secretly nail down. It's the monster that we nail down under a trapdoor, I think. Yeah. You know, it's that furry, horrible monster. So I would say that that's the price that we pay. In terms of other things that we worry about, right, that sort of ticker tape of anxieties that's constantly whipping through our heads, as you kindly pointed out that I wrote. Yeah. One thing I'd say is, I think that the biggest anxiety that most parents I see have is that they want to make their kids happy. That this is what it means if your kid is, you know, emotionally priceless to you, right? They have no economic worth, but they have high emotional worth. And all that I would stipulate on this question, or what I would say to you about this is, it's not your job. and it didn't used to be your job. And it puts a lot of pressure. It's a very tall order to make your kid happy. And it, they sense it. It's a high burden to place on them. And I think the most that any parent can do is teach your kid how to lead a good life in the Greek sense, to lead a flourishing life. You teach them how to be productive, and you teach them how to be decent, moral people. Rest is on them, you know? And that used to be more than enough. Not, you know, kind of making sure that they're happy, which is, some kids aren't ever going to be, you know?
Thank you, Jen. David, do you want to add anything? Or I have a separate question for you.
Yeah. Can you hear? The mortality I'm much more concerned about is my own. I'm 56. I look in the mirror and these ghastly signs of age every morning. My children are young and healthy, and I know, sometimes less than ideal attitude. My youngest, Jesse, and I were goofing around playing catch, and he said, "Dad, my finger." And I looked at it, "Oh, you're fine, you're fine, you're fine." It was broken. It's now at a crooked and irreparably crooked. So I think Jennifer's absolutely right that our children's happiness is not really our responsibility, although we can have a huge impact on it. And I think it's important early for kids to understand that their lives are their own, and that we're here to love them and support them and to provide for them. But parents need to understand that there's a difference between loving and smothering, and there's a difference between providing and, I'll get to that one. There's a difference between indulging, perfect. There's a difference between providing and indulging. There's a difference between encouraging and leading by the nose. And I think too often parents are, in their zeal and anxiety, they're straying over those lines too often. And as a result, we're getting kind of narcissistic, passive kids who are needy of their parents' guidance and later and later in life. As Jennifer beautifully points out in her book, the process of maturation has slowed across our culture. And in many ways, college is the new high school. And graduate school is now where one goes to specialize and polish up. And people are spending their 20s figuring out what they want to do. They're not committing to a career or a spouse until they're in their 30s, which means the procreative bell is starting to toll a little bit. So parents are having fewer children. They have more resources on which to expend on them, which puts an awful lot of pressure on kids. There are all kinds of solutions, I think. One is for parents to step back, to allow their kids more freedom, to have confidence in the work they've already done with raising the child. I think it's important to involve the older generation more, that grandparents should be, that a kid's interaction with grandparents should be more than just photo ops and papal audiences. That they have so much life experience to share with their kids, and often because if they're retired, they have more time with which to do it. I think the grandparent generation is a hugely valuable and under-tapped resource. I'd like to see families sit down to dinner together more and talk about things other than school or other than opportunities to impress. Just talk. I'll stop.
Okay. All right, I'm going to ask one last question, and then we'll go to the audience. Are we sending out mics, or are people just going to stand up? We have mics. So if you want, even while we're doing this question, if you want to raise your hand, if you have a question, we can... Oh, great, we have a few coming. Okay, it's... Oh, goodness, I'll make mine really fast. And you can go ahead and bring a mic to whoever you see. So my last question is... So, David, one thing in your book that it was a light bulb for me, even though we kind of already knew it, was that you really articulated that for teens... their lives online are every bit as real and perhaps, in fact, preferable to or as their lives in what we call real world or real
life? Non-virtual.
What is it?
VRL. Real life.
And yet at the same time we have, so for example, the American Academy of Pediatrics says that our kids should only be on screens 2 hours a day. Now, I want to confess to you that I do not abide by that, and that I swear to God, my 10-year-old son has learned more from YouTube than he has in school. So How would you respond?
I have a number of concerns about their infatuation with all things electronic. One is that it denies them the opportunity for protracted thought, protracted, uninterrupted concentration. Sit down with an idea, fiddle around with your guitar, or do some homework, and the phone is constantly busy, buzzing and chirping, and you know it requires a quick glimpse and a quick response, and I think that's bad. The other thing is that these innovations, these apps, these new technologies are coming at us so fast that nothing gets beyond the novelty stage before the next thing arrives. And so you can't really commit to any one thing and find out if it's genuinely useful because you're missing the next new thing. The degree to which the electronic devices make important to them what their friends think about everything, that they have to reach kind of a consensus on any decision, no matter how trivial, robs them of an independent self-determination. They're just simply responding to what the crowd seems to think. I think that's problematic. They're compelled to publicize everything they do, think, wear, no matter how trivial or inane. But all of it still, for me, is all still so new that it's hard to know where it's going.
And it's one of the biggest gropes.
I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah. Jen,
I'll just add.
Thank
very
you.
So this is one of the, maybe the only place where David and I slightly part company, but David's riff on this stuff, I mean, his observations about it are so exquisitely written. I just can't tell you how deeply entertaining. I said back in the green room, he writes like a drunken angel, so for this alone, you should totally read him on this stuff.
Yeah.
I disagree slightly only in this way. I mean, I hear all that, and I think it's all true. I think it was the 1950s, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a big hearing on the perniciousness of comic books. They were sure comic books were going to be responsible for the ruin of this nation's youth, that they were going to wind up raping and pillaging and stealing and, you know, doing all kinds of horrible, horrible things. And now all of us parents, of course, would kill if our children would only sit still and read comic books. But when I was a child, I watched I don't know how many hours of very bad television. Very bad television. But so did my cohort. And now some of them today are writing some of the best television out there, like The Wire and The Simpsons. And they are genuinely tremendously gratifying forms of art to me. So we all slightly panic about these forms of technology that we don't know, but it is in fact the world that they are going to be coming, you know, that they are going into. They are entering a world that's going to be scribbled in HTML code. So, you know, the world that they're going to know is that world. So if they're fluent in it and spending too much time in it, it is going to be what they do. So to pull them out of it, just because we have some kind of nostalgic attachment to a time that was more contemplative, it's nice, but I don't know if it's even practical. This might just be adaptive for them. This said, it also drives me crazy. So, you know.
Right. This could be an hour-long debate, but
yeah,
we'll
right. Okay, I don't disagree. I'm just adding
that
as a mitigate. Right, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't think there's that much difference. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Audience questions. Does someone have a mic already? Go ahead, please. Oh, go ahead.
Hi, good morning, good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. I just had a question and I have a comment. My question is, where do you see this, what I'll define as, quote, overparenting? What's the cap on it? What's the ceiling? What do we do to turn it around and kind of bring it back to what I'll define as a normal level? I think my wife and I have, we have two daughters. I don't think we have them. that are 19 and 17, and we have consistently, throughout their lives, made very conscious decisions so that we didn't fall into these patterns. And so where do we see other people doing this, or where do we, how do we get it back to what I'll define as a normal state? Hmm. And then my comment is more just a little anecdotal about the car seat. I also think the car seats are important. And you say the baby on board, and it really kills me when I see the shade and then the mirror. So then we have a mirror so the kid can look at himself, and then we have the shade to protect them. So we add another whole layer of dimension to that.
Yeah.
So if you just address that, that'd be great. Thank you.
We are in the middle of an arms race, or an inflated economy, if you want to look at it that way. And to participate in an inflated economy is to inflate it further. The arms race is, as I see it in my small world, is to become impressive to the prestige. Everyone has seen admission to a prestigious college as the parents' blue ribbon for doing a wonderful job and a referendum on the child's worth as a human being. And so high school becomes that. And kids now think that in addition to straight A's and honors courses and AP courses, they also have to paint elementary schools in Guatemala, and they have to solve global warming and cure cancer and make the all-star team in basketball. And that if they don't do that, they're somehow failing. Interesting to me, too, gone pretty much from the demographic in Wellesley is the summer job. Not a lot of kids are working anymore. They're all going off on these service trips. And then you look a few years forward, and in college, they're all going after, quote, internships. Mm-hmm. I want to know, where are the college kids who are going to Guatemala? I mean, if painting elementary schools, which is a lovely thing to do, it's an important thing to do. I'm not denigrating that at all. But if you're doing it really for the well-being of the Guatemalans, why aren't you doing it when you're in college instead of interning mm-hmm. for IBM? How we stop it, I don't really know. I think the colleges need to recalibrate a little how they're making their decisions. I'd like to see if it's logistically practical, and it probably isn't, but I'd like to see the interview come back as one of the criteria for admission. My sense is that they see through a lot of this resume stuffing. I think parents need to, particularly by the time they get to high school, parents need to consciously step back a little and give kids freedom. Give them freedom in little arenas where they'll feel independent, yet we're still reasonably certain they'll be safe and that they won't screw up their challenges. And if they screw them up, let's help them figure out what to do about it then.
Jen, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I'll add two things. First of all, you just made me think of an idea for our publisher. We share a publisher, which is that they should do a comparison. Some brave college should show the admissions essays that got kids in 1985 and the admissions essays that get kids in now, purely to show how slick and edited and perfect the ones are now. It will reflect all kinds of high-priced tutoring versus my dumbass essay, which got me into Princeton anyway, filled with grammatical. I mean, I don't even know. My mother never saw. Nobody saw my essay. You know, I typed it out on a typewriter. You know, and you know what? It was good enough. It was fine. So I would love to see that just so that we could all kind of unmask the sham that you're talking about. Colleges have to rethink this so that they can see for themselves what they're falling for. I love that idea. I hadn't even thought about the idea that colleges really are, you know, it's on them in some ways to also put an end to the nonsense.
If I can interrupt for one second. Yeah. A friend of mine, when I was in high school in the 1970s, wanted very much to go to an Ivy League college that I'll leave unnamed. And the essay question his year for the application was, who is your favorite person in history and why? And I imagine he pictured one kid writing about Albert Schweitzer and another kid writing about Muhammad and another kid writing about Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain or something. He wrote about Marie Tuscadero, who sat next to him in history class, who had the reputation of being cooperative on Friday nights. And he was very eager to... And he got in, and the courage represented in that topic, the boldness, the willingness to think about things a little differently, to me is so impressive. Sometimes I ask my students, "What's half of 8?" And they all raise their hand. It's 4. It's 4. It's 4. It's 4. It's 4. It's 4. Of course, it's 4. Well, it's also EI and half of G, isn't it? It's also 0, the lower half of the number 8, or a 3. One side, or a cursive E, the other side. And if you can get kids to think that way, I'm guessing the very smart admissions people at colleges will think, yeah, this kid has a lively imagination. Instead, we've gotten these really earnest, timid, conservative kids who are very worried about screwing up and therefore denying themselves these huge and or potentially huge and exciting discoveries.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go to the next question is over here. Yeah.
There's a great deal of discussion about over-parenting, but there's also under-parenting. parents are putting their children into daycare at earlier and younger ages, you know, 8 months, 10 months old, and so on. Their needs are met instantly. Parents are paying big money for their children to be made happy by others. What is the long-term effect? What role does this have in their child development as they get older emotionally and so on, and encounter obstacles in the world when there isn't someone there to make them happy right away?
Interesting. And I actually want to say, it was striking to me that neither of you wrote very much about child care by others in your book. So I don't know, but how would you respond to this question?
Well, it depends. I mean, child care is, for now, for most families, an economic necessity in the sense that you can't get by on one income. That America is long gone. So in some sense, having some kind of arrangement where, you know, your kid is taken care of is a requirement, right? I mean, to me, the scandal is that in all 50 states, people pay more for childcare than they do for rent. So, you know, like, my beef surrounding childcare is like, you know, why is this all on families to pay? You know, we don't have a particularly generous government that helps pitch in for families who need this kind of help. Here's the other thing I'd say. You're talking about underparenting, but I'll point one thing out. Right now, American mothers spend more time with their children than moms did in the 1960s. 4 more hours per week, to be precise. That includes working mothers. That includes the mothers who are putting their kids in daycare. It's 2 more hours per week for them. And whenever I tell this to people, at first they kind of furrow their brow and they go, that cannot possibly be right. Here's what's going on if you look at the American Time Use survey data. Back in the 60s, the emphasis was on keeping a perfect house, right? So women spent a lot of time, you know, our meals were punctual and scrumptious and perfectly prepared. Our floors were buffed to a high shine. There was no more ring around the collar. It was great, you know. But kids were put in playpens, or they were told to get on their bike and go out and, like, you know, someone would bang a gong at 6 o'clock and they'd come home.
Yeah,
right.
True.
That was parenting. I mean, it didn't look exactly like Mad Men, but like the martinis and the see you later and the kids, and that wasn't off, you know.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at the same data, well, it's very clear. Our houses are filthy. No one can cook. But man, do we spend a ton of time with our kids. And so, and this is even, by the way, reflected in language, right? Back in the 60s, if you stayed at home, what were you? You were a housewife. Emphasis on the word house. Now, if you stay at home with your child, what are you? Yeah, stay-at-home mom. You have to be a perfect mother. So, you know, it's no longer enough to simply bring home the bacon and fry it up in a pan. I mean, now you have to, like, bring home the bacon, fry it up in a pan, and then use the greasy remains to make artisanal candles for your kids, like, science project the next day. I mean, so, I'd love to see underparenting. I welcome the moment when underparenting, I just bring it on, baby. You know, like, bah, pshaw.
Thank you. Is there another audience? Yes.
Yes, I have a question to see how this kind of plays out with different cultures and classes. I've worked for 23 years with mostly lower income families in New York City as a social worker, and actually did a study abroad program, with a college prep program. So when you had talked about eating dinner, one of the most impressive things when our kids came back to, you know, Harlem and Washington Heights and so forth, was that the German kids, we went to Germany, they ate dinner together. It was like a huge kind of different, I think that's just American, but it looks very different to what you're talking about in terms of, it feels like a certain class of kids, you know, we're trying to get the kids into college, and it's not like we want trying to get more resources as opposed to them signing up for too many and that kind of pressure. So it just looks very different, but there are some similarities.
I agree, and I take great pains to remind people that I speak only about my experience in the world in which I live. I did, though, get the other day a very gratifying note from a teacher in Harlem who said to me that the speech and my book hit notes that resonated with him and his students vividly, and that he has adopted many of my ideas and methods and trying them out in his classroom to great effect. And that was tremendously gratifying to me, only it wasn't Harlem, New York. It was Harlem, Montana, which is on an Indian reservation a few miles from the Canadian border. And that was, it remains among the most gratifying reactions to my book, to think that it's helpful to people doing the Lord's work.
Yeah, I make the same distinction in my book, that I am speaking about middle-class parenting, and that there is like a whole, there's a number of tremendous books that speak to the demographic that you're talking about. I'm sure you've heard of the work of Catherine Eden and Maria Kefalet, right? Promises I Can Keep, I'm Trying as Hard as I Can. There are all these wonderful books that talk about how different it is. One thing that I'm always struck by, and you mentioned it with the family dinner, is the absence of social capital in those worlds. That, you know, these are smaller families, they're often unstable arrangements, and they don't have the same kind of social connections, the ability to roll, they don't, the myth of like the super tied, super connected poor neighborhood is exactly that, a myth. There are less social ties and less trust in these neighborhoods. And this is already a problem for middle class parents. If you have a college education, the odds that you're gonna be living near your own folks for childcare is already really low. It's even harder. I mean, whatever kind of social capital deficits we feel, no matter how many declines in family dinners that we've suffered, which Robert Putnam here at Harvard has, you know, chronicled, you know, in Bowling Alone, it's that much worse for poor families. And Kathy Eden is now working on exactly this question at Harvard. So I would love to talk. I mean, if you wanted to look at her latest research, it would probably speak exactly to your questions. Yeah.
Thank you, Jen. So I'm so sorry we have time only for one more question. I'm sorry we don't have more time. I encourage you to swarm the authors afterwards and ask more. But whoever has the mic back there, uh-huh.
One of the most difficult things when I was raising my three kids was dealing with other parents. I now have two grandchildren, and I'm watching my daughter struggle with the same thing, but it seems to be even worse.
What about the other parents?
That so-and-so's parents let them do this. They can go to the movies. They can go to the mall. They can, I mean, it's amazing to me what other parents let their kids do when my kids were growing up 20 years ago. But how do you say to your children or your grandchildren, that's okay for them, but our family's different, and not saying that?
No, I'd say, too bad you chose the wrong parents. And the other thing, too, is I always raise a skeptical eye about the information I'm receiving about what other parents are allowing. My feeling, you have to trust the good work you did when they're little and have faith in them and not worry so much about other parents. The competition to keep up with the Joneses has become now, let's bury the Joneses. Let's just dance on their graves.
Smoke them.
Who has the time to worry about that silliness? I certainly don't. Each kid is important. Each kid is special. Each kid is unique and valuable. And let's celebrate all of them and not try to elbow the other out of the way for our shot at the cultural plums.
Yeah, so my line to my kid is, this is not a democracy. You get one vote and I get 10. I do the same. So it's the same idea. I mean, it's the exact same, you know. And there is, right, I think that other parents, you know, can be somewhat tyrannizing in that, you know, oh, you know, my child, I send my kid to the local public school, and I just ran into a mom who decided that she was going to take her kid out, and this kid is now learning Mandarin at his school, and, you know, learning all kinds of high-level math. By the way, he's six. Okay, I mean, just to put this in perspective, you know, and I just had to sit there and, you know, bite my tongue until it bled, because, you know, I think that I can almost tell you for sure that a lot of the parents who walk around talking with great certainty about what they are doing it is in almost inverse proportion to how uncertain they secretly feel about what they're doing. No one really knows. I think Facebook and social media also makes things incredibly complicated. You know, you are able to curate these perfect pictures of what your family life looks like. I actually just tweeted last year at exactly this time. This is like the time when on Facebook you just look at those families surrounded with like pumpkin patch pictures. You know, the kids are all smiling in the pumpkin patch. And I finally tweeted, you know, families with all those pumpkin patch pictures, cut it out. I know about the meltdown in the car on the way there. You know, you got to tune it out. That's...
Thank you, Jen. Thank you. So on that note, I just want to thank you, the audience, for coming, and our really amazing authors who, they're not just great speakers, these are spectacular books. And I think one thing that Jen points out is that we lack folk wisdom to help guide us in our parenting. Well, guess what? This is as close as we get. So please join me in thanking Jennifer Senior and David McCullough Jr. And is it okay that they, for people to say yes? And please come up with the questions you didn't have a chance to ask. Thank you.